Hello everyone and welcome to the Daily Friend. I'm Nicholas Lorimer, standing in for Sikle, who is out and about travelling the country this week. With me today is our project manager, Mr. Terence Corrigan. Terence, how are you today?
I'm well, thanks, Nicholas. And yourself?
I'm very well, thank you, sir. And Herman, how are you today? Herman
Pretorius. In fine form, thank you, Nick.
Analyst for the CRA and all-round clever clogs. Okay, so let's talk about land reform a bit. And so we brought in our land reform expert, Mr. Corrigan. Terence, tell us about the Rojase judgment and what it means, what happened, what it is.
Yeah, very interesting case this. Mr. Rojase has been farming this piece of land since the early 1990s. It belonged to one of the erstwhile homeland administrations, and obviously then that was transferred into...
So which province is this in, sorry?
This is in Limpopo, I believe.
Okay.
In the course of time, this was the ownership of the land was then passed onto South Africa, and I think it was about 2002 he made an application to buy the land. I mean, he wanted to do what most farmers, most successful commercial farmers in South Africa do, own the plot that he's producing on, and apparently he's producing very, very well, cattle and. He was providing mentorship to other farmers. This was, by all accounts, a sort of poster child achievement, the kind of thing that that government, with its newfound emphasis on land reform as a boon to South Africa, should have grabbed with both hands. But the wheels of bureaucracy grind slowly, and the transfer was simply not made, and I think it was about 2011 or so that that the government then decided, well, it wasn't actually going to sell it to him, but didn't bother to communicate this fact for another year, but said no, well, you know, rather than selling it, he could have a long term lease. I think they gave him 5 years initially, and then that expired, and then it seemed to roll on from month to month. Understandably, Mr. Rojase wanted to buy this place that he'd been farming for more than three decades. So there was also an issue with people moving onto the land and him being unable to evict them because he wasn't technically the owner. Eventually, he went to court, and the court was absolutely scathing about the government's conduct, and ordered that the land be sold to him. More or less on the conditions that they had originally agreed to. Two things I think stand out. First of all, was the government's papers in the court matter, which were very, very revealing. Said something to the effect of, in fact, I think they used this exact phrase: "Black farming households are, in government's view, not to own land. They must exist as state tenants with these long leases, which may or may not be renewed, to which you can attach all sorts of conditions." And secondly, it turns out that they are now appealing the judgment.
Let me get this straight.
Yes.
A successful black farmer, yes, asks to buy land from the government. Mm-hmm. The government says yes. Then they say no.
Yes.
Then they stuff him around for a bit.
Yeah.
And then they spend taxpayers' money to prevent him from being able to own the land after they lose in court.
That's more or less the size of it.
Herman, is this a chilling vision of what land reform is going to look like?
Incredibly so. The uniqueness of the Rojase case, it cuts across this narrative that land is a racial issue. Were the government to be bona fide in trying to ensure real land redistribution, real land reform to get previously disadvantaged South Africans onto the property ladder, into the agricultural business, then, as Terence says, the Rojase, Mr. Rojase would have been a poster child for the successful drive to involve more South Africans in the agricultural economy and in terms of owning immovable assets. The fact that that isn't the case just makes a mockery of the idea that the ANC or the government has any interest in addressing inequalities of the past, but this is purely an ideological play to get the state into businesses that it, or into areas of society it has no business being in. So Mr. Rakase, really, he's a poster child in two ways, I think, in what could be successful land reform, but also in making clear the ideological intent of the ANC being not to redress injustice, but to further its own, you know, agenda of state interventions and state ownership.
Yeah, I think that's very well put. I think, of course, on top of the ideological grounds, there does seem to be a motivation, as this case makes clear, that it's more important for land to be put into the patronage, political patronage control than it is for successful black farmers to emerge. Terence, do you have any concluding thoughts?
No, it's, this just illustrates, you know, the failings of land reform and the sort of dog and pony show logic of what's going on. I'm very seldom at a loss for words, but I must confess to being so here. I think I can't do better than quote what the legal journalist Karen Morn said when the first judgment came out. I hope the department has the good sense not to try and appeal this. Well, apparently they don't.
Yeah, the fact that it went to appeal. I mean, it's one thing that they decided to go for on appeal. The fact that it's been dragging on since the early 2000s, that says one thing about, you know, state incompetence. The fact that they are now going on to appeal this judgment says it's beyond incompetence. It's villainy.
just one final thing. Mr. Rakase is now in his late 70s. So if they are looking at another 30-year lease, well, one can only hope that long life is a gift.
Indeed, I think that's a very horrifying vision of what a world with expropriation without compensation could look like in South Africa.
Well, at least the ANC have fined a non-racial policy. They will victimize the little guy whether he is white or black.
Well, you know, I'll challenge you slightly. As I say, their court papers were very clear. Black farming households get to do this.
That's true. How does one react to that?
It's very strange to see apartheid thinking completely hard-coded into the view of the department that black farmers shouldn't be allowed to own their land outright.
Yes.
Quite horrifying. Anyway, let's move on. So there was a bit of a scandal that's broken over the weekend. The DA is in trouble again, as they've been for a while, but this time it's specifically its leader, Mr. Musi Maimane, who is alleged to have received a free car from Marcus Uster of Steinhoff fame, the company that went down for insider trading and overvaluation. At a time that there were MPs from the DA attacking Steinhoff in Parliament, Musi appears to have been driving around a car free of charge that was given to him by their CEO. Since then, the federal chairperson, James Self, has said that the car was actually a party car and that Musi was simply using it for work. Although there has been some skepticism thrown on this and that that's a cover-up. Herman, what is your take on this scandal?
Well, it's a real problem for the DA, or for the current DA leadership on many levels. One of the few things I think the DA accomplished in the Zuma years and slightly as part of a spillover into the Ramaphosa years is this idea that if all else fails, the DA will have some position against corruption. They haven't been implicated in something like the VBS. They haven't been implicated in, you know, being slightly ANC-ish in terms of the gravy train. And
it does always seem that even ANC voters have said, well, they may be evil white racists, but yes, at least they're not corrupt.
I mean, we see these polls where I remember before the election this year there was this poll if the ANC, the DA, and the EFF were banks, or if Cyril Ramaphosa and Musi Maimane and Julius Malema were bank managers, who would you trust with your money? And Maimane won that because for all their, you know, evils, they somehow managed to position themselves sustainably as the, you know, the corruption busters of to whatever extent that might be true. But we have now seen in 1 year, since the election, the collapse of, I think, two crucial narratives for the DA. The one narrative is that they are a sustainably, consistently growing party, that they will, at some point, inevitably become the party of national government in some form. That has collapsed with their electoral performance in the elections in May. And the other important narrative was this one of corruption busting. You don't need much of a scandal to tarnish your reputation. You really, in fact, you might not need an actual scandal, something that just could conceivably be presented as a scandal. Now, until the details of this whole thing becomes clear, I don't know whether there was illegality or whatever. But the political idiocy of being of playing fast and loose with probably the greatest reputational asset of your party is insane, and Mr. Maimane will, I think, rightly be subject to some severe consequences.
It does seem as though in the world of corruption scandals, this is not quite as bad as almost anything that the ANC or EFF has gotten involved
in. No one lost their pension.
Precisely, yeah. No one lost a pension. No government money was stolen.
And the lights are still on.
Lights are still on. But it does seem, I mean, there's no obvious quid pro quo here which would make it into a proper corruption scandal. It just seems untoward.
But, I think that the DA faces an inherently difficult difficult time with much of the commentariat and the chattering classes. You know, there's something that's almost uncool about them. So they, their whistles have to be three times as clean. Something small like something relatively small, can drag on for a long, long, long time. You know, we remember, for instance, the open toilet situation in the Western Cape. Now, in Cape Town, the fact that there were other instances where this situation was almost replicated just seemed to attract no particular attention. So, yes,
it's like Gareth and Onslin wrote, I think, last year. End of last year or beginning of this year, that the DA is held to perfection in terms of standards, and the ANC is held to avoiding failure. There was this, this vast difference between expectations, and it's borne out. But if you're going to be a political leader and if you're going to be a political party, it's no good complaining that people are treating you unfairly. That's part of the job. And as Terence says, you have to be so spotless.
I think that's the core of the issue here, is it demonstrates that Musi seems to have shown some very bad judgment politically, because what this does is it feeds the narrative that DA is the puppet of, as they call it, white monopoly capital, because he seems to have taken a gift from the dodgiest company in the country, the one that's been in all the headlines as the poster child of evil corporate
corrupt
greed.
Private sector
evil. Greed. We'll see how it plays out, but I suspect that it's not going to go particularly well for Musi, especially if evidence emerges that this wasn't a party car.
But also, I think one has to take a step back and be honest that this is part of a concerted effort. These leaks I would be willing to stake a lot of what I possess. I wanted to say own, but then I realized I'm incredibly poor. But as much as on this being, internal leakages, the DA, his opposition in the DA moving to discredit him, to get rid of him, and it might very well work. It's difficult to see him bounce back.
Yeah, it's very much looks as though the vultures are circling.
You've got the house thing of a few weeks ago.
Yeah, exactly.
Now you've got it's just this drip.
Probably
feed.
Not the last.
No,
we'll see.
And that's how, and in politics, that's how you destroy someone's credibility by drip. You don't come out with a big scandal because that can be managed. If it's this constant little storm pattering along, it creates a new momentum. Like what happened with, I think, Patricia de Lille. Yes. That whole thing. Instead of it being one blow up, it was just this continual weakening of a reputational position of strength for the DA. And I think the same principle is being applied here to Mr. Maimane.
Yes. It's going to, looks like it's going to turn out quite badly for the DA and open up the possibility of a new leader. But we'll have to see how things develop.
Although the issue there is, you know, who would really take over?
Yes.
I mean, is there's no obvious challenger in the wings, but that's for another episode.
That indeed might be a blessing in disguise.
Okay, so DA is suffering again. But let's talk about something a little bit more optimistic, perhaps, if one takes a certain look at it, or maybe a bit more pessimistic. Over the weekend, the ANC's National Executive Council, NEC, which is the sort of most powerful body in the ANC, was having a meeting to discuss various policies. And Tito Mboweni, the finance minister, gave a presentation to this where he laid out the facts of the country's economic situation, and they are not particularly good. He recommended some very sensible things, such as selling parastatals and making various structural reforms to the economy. In fact, this seems to be all in line with his economic paper that he put out recently, and the IRR has made a submission on this paper as well.
Quite a pretty
positive one. There are some weaknesses to the paper. It doesn't go far enough.
But a step in the right direction.
But it's very much one of the best pieces of policy document that's come out of the ANC in a long time. There's been some serious opposition to this bill, to this proposed economic plan by Kasato and the SACP.
Right.
Terence, what are your thoughts? Do you think that there's any realistic chance that these suggestions will be implemented?
You know, I look at this alongside the announcement of yet another advisory committee to provide yet more input. I must say, I can't help thinking that kicking for touch has become the game plan. There seems to be a congenital inability to draw a line and say this is actually what we're going to defend. I think that what Mr. Mboweni said was is a message that needs to be heard. We talk about Eskom's debt, you know, being the size of the mining and agriculture combined. It's monstrous. I don't know. Words fail me once again, which is odd for me, as I said. So am I overly optimistic? No. I think that there's a need for whoever is at the helm of the state to be willing to take a great deal of damage, and I think this is possibly something that in a political sense goes beyond a corruption scandal or whatever. It's to actually shake the unity of your party. Now my reading of the situation is that before anything is contemplatable for South Africa, the leadership of the ANC looks to its own interests as a party. And the most basic one is whether there is some form of sham unity or unity, sham unity, pseudo unity, something that looks like that looks close enough to unity where at least the conflicts can be managed from public view. So, you know, when you have Kasatu saying no way, I really think that puts a huge damper on the prospects for this being realized.
And on part of that, it does look like the information about what Tito was saying came out when the presentation itself that he was giving was leaked directly to the media. So we can speculate and suggest that perhaps this is maybe Tito trying to build outside media pressure to implement his policies. Herman, what do you think?
Well, that would slot in kind of into the modus operandi of the CR17 campaign, ironically. It is Ralph Matekine is in his book on what Ramaphosa's turn. He makes the point that Ramaphosa positioned himself for the leadership election in the ANC very much in terms of public debate rather than in terms of internal party politics. And it Well, the jury's out on whether it worked, but there's certainly something to be said for the fact that the ANC's best ideas are more popular, or the ANC's best people and best ideas are more popular in the country than the party themselves. If you go back to look at the approval rating of Ramaphosa versus Nkosazana Dlamini-Zuma during the leadership election, it was, I mean, there was a 20-30 point difference in how the public looked at the two candidates. And this a presentation appearing again in the public sphere, not being an internal party matter, might be a way to harness the available civil pressure and corporate pressure to get in behind this plan, so that the debate can almost happen in society at large, and then the Mbowenis of the ANC might say, well, look where society is going. The ANC cannot remain opposed to where the country is. So if it is, if it was a strategic leak, it might very well be. It makes sense to try and win the debate where you can win it, in the public sphere rather than in the party dominated by the leftist factions of the ANC.
I think what this does show is that now the ANC leadership can't say that they didn't know. It does look like Mboweni laid out the harsh, cold reality of our financial and economic situation.
But I must say, Mboweni has surprised me in sticking to this plan. I had no idea what would happen to this plan. It's a very welcome surprise. But when this plan came out, I couldn't see it going a step further. And it might not have gone a step further, but it hasn't moved a step back, and it might in fact be inching closer to some form of implementation, and that should be welcomed.
You know, perhaps what we're seeing here is a kind of gasp of the of that 1990s era cadre, if I can use the dreadful nomenclature.
Of pragmatists.
Well, yes, you know, people who realize that you know, South Africa was down a fiscal hole in the early 1990s, and seizing the commanding heights of the economy was probably not the greatest idea. I think that, and I think in Mboweni's case, you know, we do have him to thank, I suppose, for some of the labor legislation. So we put that in the negative column. But you know, he also went off and became the head of the Reserve Bank. And in that position was willing to say things that seemed to be directly contradictory to what he was doing as Labour Minister. He took aim at some holy cows, affirmative action and whatever. I think that there is probably, you know, a certain political heritage there, but also a certain maverick personality. And also maybe the fact that he doesn't believe he doesn't feel he has to make a career out of this. Mm-hmm. He can afford to alienate people. Mm-hmm. The problem, of course, is, you know, if he is defenestrated, what comes next?
Yeah.
It does say something about the twisted insides of the ANC's politics, that Cyril and even Tito, who is not particularly popular but is still more popular than people like Ace Makashula, seem to be at such a struggling against such a powerful force inside the party. They are so much more popular with the public.
Yes.
You think that they would be able to just sort of run away with the apparatus of the party.
Yeah.
And yet here they are fighting an uphill battle to implement the things that will prevent us falling off a fiscal cliff. It's not like they're making these in a healthy economic they're not making these suggestions a healthy climate.
In terms of public perception, imagine an ANC with Ramaphosa at the head, Naledi Pandor as deputy president, and Tito Mboweni as the economic maverick. The public, whether they would rightly or wrongly, the public will fall behind that. Those are people with some integrity, some gravitas,
And opinion polling has shown this. It's shown that even Tito, who's not that popular, has about sort of 32% approval. Cyril has in the 60s.
Yes.
And people like Ace Makashula have down at 12, 11, yeah, somewhere down there. So they are much more applicable to the population.
But it's really bizarre that you have two South Africas. You have the South Africa of the ANC, where they have to appoint yet another economic panel and committee to discover magically what's going wrong. And then you have the actual ANC, where everyone knows what's going wrong. There is no uncertainty, I think, among the general public who understand good business common sense of what should be done. And it's these parallel worlds. And if you look at the polling done by R.W. Johnson and published in his book Fighting for the Dream, even a majority of ANC members, ANC your ordinary members, want more pro-market, pro-business policies. So it's bizarre that we have to fight this battle to only get our governing party to acknowledge that reality might just be reality.
Does seem as though our sort of democratic culture has been seriously subverted by the internal politics of the ANC. And on that somewhat gloomy note, thank you very much for joining us today. If you like what we do at the IRR, you can join us by giving a small monthly donation. You can SMS your name to 32823. Terms and conditions apply, and SMSs cost 1 rand. Thank you very much, and we'll see you on the Wednesday edition of The Daily Friend.